and you no longer have this divergence associated with this three-form flux from this wrapped D5 frame. So that's basically the intuitive idea behind why this Klebanov-Strassler solution works. So the idea here, the story that was told about this, the supergravity solution, you start in the UV at some large radius on this cone with some ND3 brains and some ND5 brains that are wrapped. This is supposed to be a SUN plus M cross SUN gauge theory. And there's supposed to be this long chain of Seiberg dualities which takes you at small r in the infrared to a confining SUM gauge theory. Okay. So the important point I just want to emphasize here is this: with this Klebanov-Strassler solution, what you have is you have some three-form flux which threads this three-sphere at small r, and you have an SUM confining gauge theory. And with this, I hope to show you how these QCD strings work. But before that goes, we go on, I just wanted to emphasize one additional point about where this QCD calculation is going to be valid. So I just wanted to point out that, so if you look at the way these Seiberg dualities work, you start at some radius R1 with some SUN plus M cross SUN gauge theory. And then you flow to a smaller radius with an SUN cross SUN minus M gauge theory. And if you look at the details of the supergravity solution, you'll see that the two radii are related in this way. Okay. So you know that supergravity should, these solutions are generally valid when the curvature is large compared to the string scale, I guess, in some sense. So this G string M is going to be quite large, and G string itself will be small. So since G string M is very large, you see this factor here is going to be very close to 1. And so these two radii are very close together. So these Seiberg duality steps are very, very close together, exponentially close together in this flow. So the point I wanted to emphasize here is that in the supergravity limit, you're only sort of in this confining regime very, very close to the tip of the cone. The minute you move just a little bit off, you move to some other kind of gauge theory with other degrees of freedom. So, and that's not really pure superangles. That's not really confining pure superangles. But in some sense, we're in the same universality class as n equals 1 confining superangles theory. But the calculation I'm doing, just to emphasize again, right, it's going to be valid at large G string M and small G string. And this small G string M would be the pure superangles, but that's not really where we're doing this calculation. Okay. So we have this wonderful supergravity solution, which is supposed to be tell us something about strongly coupled confining SUM gauge theory, right? You know, historically, gauge theory calculations, when this gauge theory is confining, are very difficult. You need some kind of lattice simulation. But now maybe we can use this Klebanov-Strassler solution as a laboratory for doing these gauge theory calculations very easily without too much trouble. So what would you want to calculate? Well, what we thought we could calculate would be these confining strings, the flux tubes that connect Q quarks with Q antiquarks. Okay. So just to do a brief literature review here, there has been some progress in calculating these tensions in the past. For example, there's a paper by Douglas and Schenker a while back about softly broken N equals 2 gauge theories. And there's another paper slightly more recently by Hanani, Strassler, and Zaffaroni about an MQCD approach to these confining strings. And in both cases, they found the tension had this sine law form. So you notice it goes from 0 when Q equals 0 to 0 again when Q equals M. Well, why does that? It's because if you have M quarks, they can form some kind of baryon, and then there's no reason for them to be bound together with M antiquarks. They just separate out. Another thing that's interesting about this formula is that it's convex. So you notice from this inequality that if you had a q plus q prime string, it would be stable with respect to decay into a q and a q prime string, right? Because the energy here is less than the energy here. So the tension of strings with higher q is, these strings are stable. That's the point I want to make. So in this Klebanov-Strassler solution, what we're going to find is we're going to find a very similar form for the tension.
Is there a general large N argument that has to happen? I mean, going back to Greek, just a large N H theory period without knowing about who representations.
Not that I'm aware of.
They're not BPS. And this is,
yeah, they're not BPS. That's another important point. Yeah, these confining strings are not BPS. So a priori, there's, I guess, no particularly good reason to expect they have some nice formula like this. So how do we do this calculation in the gauge theory? I mean, in the Klebanov-Strassler background. So as I was saying before, at the tip of the cone, what you have is you have 3 plus 1 Minkowski space, and you have a 3 sphere. And all this stuff, these are just constants. All this stuff here. And you also have a three-form flux, which threads this three-sphere. The NSNS flux, you can forget about it, just goes to zero at the tip. And the C-form flux is going to be unimportant for our calculation. It's just, it's in the wrong directions to contribute to the to this calculation. So what are these Q-strings? What do we propose these Q-strings are? We want to propose they're, you can model them as Q incident fundamental strings, say, in the time and one space direction. Okay. And we want to propose that this three-form flux here will blow up these fundamental strings into a D3 brain. And in particular, this D3 brain will still be in the zero and one directions, but it will also wrap a two-sphere on this three-sphere. So why is that stable? It's stable because of this three-form flux. The three-form flux stabilizes this two-sphere, so it doesn't just collapse to zero. And we're going to do this calculation using the DBI action. So you're probably wondering why I wrote that. So there's this constant, why I wrote bottle of wine up there. There's this constant A0, which comes from some details of the Klebanov-Strassler solution. So when you take the limit at small r, you get this nasty-looking integral, which you can do numerically, and you get some number. And you plug in everything here, and you get some number here, which is 0.93. It's very close to 1. So we'd like to have a better physical understanding of where this number comes from. And maybe that would come if someone could actually do this integral analytically. And if they did that, I'm offering a bottle of wine. It's kind of a silly thing. But so what was that? Do the integral numerically?
Or? You said the bottle of wine, somebody does it numerically.
Right.
And you know this goes out of order, right?
Well, maybe I'll get an answer then. I didn't say what kind of wine. I'll call this number B. And B is going to be close to 1.93.
Did you see the D3 brains are wrapped on a non-trivial S2?
They're wrapped on a
trivial S2. It's trivial. It's just blown up.
It's just Myers. Yeah, essentially. Although, yeah, I've gotten into some trouble about Myers effect working with strings versus with D strings, or NSNS flux versus Ramon flux and so forth. But I think that's essentially the idea. So you could do this directly, just write down some probe brain for this, and you would get exactly the same answer as what I'm going to show. Or you can do a trick, you can S-dualize, and then you can notice in the literature that this calculation was basically done before. So we did it both ways, we got the same answer. But I'll show you this way because it's simpler for the purposes of presentation. So you know S-duality will take this Ramon flux to an NS and S flux. You know this electric flux in the 0, 1 directions under S-duality will go into the 2-sphere directions. and it's got this form here, and Q tells you how many fundamental strings you have. And then you just plug in, and you notice you don't even need a West amino term here. You just get the DBI action here for this probe D3 brain. And you work through the algebra, and you get this nice formula down here, this trigonometric formula for an effective potential for this D3 brain. So what's psi? Psi is just this polar angle on the S3. Parameterizes what S2 you're wrapping. So you minimize this. You get some fairly, you get a slightly non-trivial formula here. It would be trivial if B were 1. That's the point here. So B was close to 1, so it's almost trivial. So if B were 1, right, then the minimum would be achieved when the psi angle was pi q over m, and you get some nice sine law for the tension. You don't quite get that. You get almost a sine, which is almost this Douglas, Schenker, Hanani, Strasser, Zaffaroni result I talked about at the beginning. Oh, just to... emphasize the geometry here, in case it's not clear. You have some S3, and this red line here is supposed to be some S2, which this D3 brain wraps, and the psi here is the polar angle. So as psi goes from 0 to m, this S2 becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, and then smaller and smaller and smaller and disappears.
So where's the discrepancy?
The discrepancy is in that B that's different from 1. And I can't solve that equation exactly for the minimum. I can do it numerically, and I can show you the difference. This dotted line is the sine formula, and the solid line is what you get when this B is not quite 1. Yes?
In a few more terms, when you take this D3 brain, you don't only have the body production of the D3 brain. I mean, there are more terms which come because of the curvature of the D3 brain or because of the back reaction of the D3 brain. They could also mess up this complication.
Sure, you mean like alpha prime or G string corrections?
No. They usually generically have the same relevance in the first. I mean, when you expand your action, you get a minus angle to the fourth, and then you get a minus angle to the angle cube. And usually there's also like a minus an angle square, a psi square term, which continues a back-to-back reaction. And you can, I mean, generically, it doesn't.
Yeah, we'd expect the back reaction to be order 1 over m, though, right? Mm-hmm. Or no?
Yes, but if you count the powers, you have x to the fourth, then you have 1 over square root of m times x cubed, and then you have 1 over m times x squared. And if you evaluate it at the minimum, you find that actually cannot go the way, even if it has the wrong power of 1 over m.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a generic fact that happens in the liquid Schrammick fraction, in the it may mess up. I mean, this combination, I mean, you may get a different minimum, which might have the right, where this discrepancy may not exist.
That very well may be true. I guess the one thing I would say is that this Bacchus, Douglas, Schweigert paper, which I just quoted, in their case, this result, this sine result, was actually exact. And they were able to show that by looking at the WZW model corresponding to this pro-brain action. So, I mean, from this pro-brain action, I don't know, maybe you'd expect to just get results for small q and maybe there'd be other terms like the one Yosef is describing. But at least in their case, it seemed that this sine result was exact. So the last thing I'd like to show you in this vein is a Monte Carlo simulation, which I'm not responsible for. It was done by a group of people from Italy, quite recently, actually. And they were looking at SU4 and SU6, Yang-Mills theory, on a lattice, and non-supersymmetric, of course. And they were looking at ratios of Q-string tensions, which are shown here. The fact that it's a ratio makes this slightly confusing. So you notice that for SU4, there's really only one independent ratio, because the tension of the one string is the same as the tension of the three string for SU4. And since you're looking at a ratio, these have to be one. So the only independent dot here is the two string. And similarly for SU6, you only get a two string and a three string that are independent. The others are the same isometry. So these points are their Monte Carlo simulation results, these ratios. And you see that they lie nicely along this sine formula. And these other lines where there are no points, these are the other thing they tested, just a simple parabola, quadratic scaling law.
So that's a...
You might wonder if there are enough parameters here to change the parabola a little bit, but they're apparently not. You need two constants to make sure this parabola goes through zero for the zero string and zero for the M string, and then you're looking at a ratio which takes away the last degree of freedom for this parabola. So this seems a pretty convincing result that for this kind of gauge theory, at least, you get some sine law, not something else.
Well, it's three numbers.
Three numbers, yeah. That was kind of a nice plot, so related to what I was doing, so I decided to show it.
But I guess I want to understand what this sort of model is here. So the calculation you did doesn't give an exact sine,
right?
A small deviation from it.
Right.
And the other calculations that have been done gave an exact sine. And I guess this data is not good enough to tell the difference between them.
Probably not.
But are there just different approximations that are being made and giving slightly different answers, or is it? How do we understand this slight discrepancy between exact sine
and I think that's a good and probably open question. I can mention one other result. We also did this pro-brain calculation for this Maldacena Nunez supergravity background. That also gave an exact sine law, no discrepancy. So there's only this Klebanov-Strassler background that gives some discrepancy. And presumably, I guess the moral I'd like to, the point I'd like to emphasize is the sine law seems to work well enough, but there may be small corrections if you can measure things with sufficient sensitivity.
But it is something non-universal. I mean, that's what's coming out of the fact that you get different answers in different ways.
Yeah.
So what's surprising is that it seems to be universal in so many cases.
It's not universal, but it goes one way.
It depends on physics, that it's sort of not just in the QCD limit, but how you embed QCD in this larger conformal theory. For example, in the original thing I did with Matt, you get nothing like this because we don't, our vacua aren't even sort of the end vacua that are involved. But actually, no, it's a different end.
Yeah.
But I think actually, the thing with math, the massive theory. You know what that gives? I should know that.
I don't know what it gives.
Yeah. I was going to say it gives something totally different, but now I'm not sure that it does.
Doesn't give a sign.
Doesn't give a sign?
Doesn't give a sign. But why is...
Has someone done that?
You had in your paper, right? You had like four strings. You had like D1 strings. D1 is 85.
Right, but I don't remember. I don't remember asking this particular question, which is what we should have, which is how it depends on the Q. I mean, there was no explicit Q formula in there, we just didn't ask this question.
Really non-universal? Isn't it awfully surprising that you keep getting the same answer? Almost the same answer.
Well, anyway, is this ever, if I look at QCD, non-service method QCD, before the grades in the company,
I'm not sure I understand.
Hey, you can, there's a parameter.
Yes.
This is the limit as the A goes to zero, G goes to scale.
You mean away from the continuum limit? Is that what you're asking?
Right.
Like in strong coupling?
Yeah.
I mean, so it's a strong coupling calculation for some Casimir.
I mean, is there, I'm trying to understand what it is. Do you know what happens there if they just move on the lattice?
No.
That should be trivial.
And in string coupling, don't you get a kink because you put kind of, you,
if I have two.
You get the Keslier and the Q represent.
That's a Hamiltonian formulation. Again, depends whether you're Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
Maybe I should go on. Maybe I'll go on. We can try and understand what you mean later. So that was the first part of the talk, and now I'd like to talk about moving beyond the conifold and trying to address other situations which are very similar, but where before it seemed hard to make progress. The reasoning here, right, is that we've extracted so much information from T11, it'd be nice to have some more examples, some more five-dimensional Einstein spaces in particular. These are the non-spherical horizons of Morrison and Plusser. But the problem, if you want to use these kinds of spaces, is that you usually don't know the metric, and in many cases you also don't even know the gauge group, so it's not really clear what you're doing. But maybe you don't need the metric in order to make some progress. And what's an important quantity for these supergravity solutions where you think you need the metric but you don't really, but maybe you don't? So the quantity I'd like to talk about in this portion of the talk is the volume, where naively, right, you take a determinant of the metric and you integrate. And this volume is important in these ADS-CFT theories. So now I'm back in the conformal field theory ADS dual. I'm not interested in these non-conformal generalizations that I was just talking about where you get confinement. So in these ADS-CFT duals, right, you have some phi-4 influx, which corresponds to the stack of D3 brains sitting at the tip of these cones. And in order to normalize that phi-4 influx properly, to know how many D3 brains you have, you need to know the volume. And so that's one reason the volumes are nice. Another reason is that they turn out to be proportional to the central charge. So it's one of those crucial quantities for conformal field theory. So what did we do? We were able to calculate the volume of a large class of these spaces without knowing an explicit metric. So what's the large class? The large class, you take some weighted homogeneous polynomial in Cn plus 1. So what's that? You write down some polynomial in z0, z1, up through zn. And you note that if you multiply each of the variables, you scale them each with respect to some complex constant lambda with an appropriate power called the weight, the polynomial behaves in this fashion. You can just factor out the lambdas with an exponent proportional to their degree, d, and you get the old polynomial back. So, right, wi here, these will be the weights, and d I'm going to call the degree of this polynomial. So the claim, right, is that, well, the first claim, this is this, the spaces we calculated volume of are going to be very closely related here. So the claim is that you look at the space cut out by f equals 0, you get a cone because of the scaling with respect to lambda. So you can break up the metric into two pieces, the radial part and the level surface, the base of the cone. Okay. So I want to claim that our formula gives the volume with respect to the base of the cone. Okay.
For any polynomial, for any space that came this way?
Just a second. So there's a theorem due to Tian and Yao. So I want to define a quantity called the index, which will be the sum of the weights minus the degree. And the theorem says that if this index is positive, this locus of points cut out by f equals 0 is a Ricci flat metric. And I believe that it's just a simple problem in differential geometry to show that the base then is an Einstein metric. And get this nice volume formula. So there's some caveats here. There's some additional caveats to what this polynomial should be like, which go under the names well-formedness and quasi-smoothness, which I don't really want to get too much into. Quasi-smoothness, I believe, It's just the requirement that this cone doesn't have any singularities except at the tip. And well-formedness is a condition which is a complicated condition on the weights, which maybe I can address a little bit more at the end of the talk. So I have this nice volume formula, which I can...
Smoothness is a condition also on the weights?
Yeah, although I think maybe it's probably easiest just to say that, you know, the partial derivatives of this polynomial with respect to all the variables vanish simultaneously only at the tip of the cone. I think that's an easier way of looking at it. So I get some nice formula here, which depends on these quantities, the degree, the dimension, and this W, the product of the weights. And to give you a sense of how this formula works, here are some examples. So for example, you could take some linear relation in the Z's, okay? So that cuts out some copy of Cn, n-dimensional complex space inside n plus one-dimensional complex space, okay? Well, n-dimensional complex space, that's just a cone over a sphere, S, Cn minus one, an odd-dimensional sphere. So you can plug in the weights and the degree corresponding to this polynomial back up in the formula, and you'll see you get the volumes of all these spheres appropriate. So another example is T11. It's this quadratic relation in the Z's I wrote down at the beginning of the talk. You can, again, plug in the numbers up here, and you see you'll get the, I believe it's 16 pi cubed over 27, which is this canonical volume for T11. And the last example is this ALE space. This is S3 mod some cyclic subgroup of SU2. And again, you find that you get exactly what you'd expect.
Can you get the TNN spaces?
No, I don't think so, because I don't think if I have a cone over those spaces, they're not Calabi-Yau, right? Because TPQ for P and Q not equal to 1 are not supersymmetry preserving. So I don't know how to even write a polynomial for those spaces. One technical point here that I should probably clear up is that volumes, they usually have dimension, and dimensions of, say, length to some power, and there's no length of any power in here. So where did I bury that? I buried that here. Basically, in the way I wrote this metric, you'll see that the Ricci curvature, if I write the metric this way, it's just some numerical constant times the metric on the base of this cone. And so generically, you'll see some cosmological constant or some other constant with dimensions written here. Instead, I've just written a numerical constant. So if you want to put the dimension back in, you have to change this. You have to put some length here. And then you'll see a length appear in the volume in the right way. And just to give you some sense of what this normalization means, for example, for the spheres, this choice corresponds to unit radius. So I'll give a proof of that at the end if I have time. In the meantime, I'd like to talk about why this formula is interesting. So I mentioned briefly, right, you need to know the volume in order to know how many D3 brains you had in the stack, given some supergravity solution. You know that this integral over the five-form flux on this Einstein manifold X5 is proportional to the number of D3 brains. So you just go through the supergravity solution, and you'll find out that the volume that appears, for example, in the warp factor and in the normalization of this five-form flux. So that's kind of the boring reason for why. Well, I think it's not so boring, but not so complicated either for why this volume formula is interesting. Another reason is that the volume is proportional to 1 over the central charge. And that can be used in some interesting ways. So a while back, Klebanov and Witten proposed some series of correspondences between two different theories. You have some Z2 orbifold of S5, This is supposed to be dual to an n equals 2 supersymmetric SUN cross SUN gauge theory. Okay. So you have this in the UV, and then what you could do, for example, is you could break some of the SUSY by adding a mass term. So in particular, you add a mass term to the chiral multiplet, which sits inside the vector multiplet in this n equals 2 theory. This flows down to some n equals 1 SUN cross SUN theory, and Klebanov and Witten argue that this should be dual to ADS5 cross T11, this conifold theory. Okay. So Steve Gubser, a little while after that, realized that this had some implications for the central charge. In particular, if you look at the ratio of the central charge in the infrared and the ultraviolet, those should be related to ratio of the volumes of this S5 mod Z2 and this T11. And since you had explicit metrics on these two spaces, you could just compute this on the gravity side. You get 27 over 32. And you could also compute this ratio on the gauge theory side with some results from Griesserou, Johansson, and I've forgotten the names, but they'll appear later. You could compute this on the gauge theory side independently. You compare the two numbers, and you see they agree. And that's kind of a nice, complicated check of ADS-EFT. So this was later generalized in a later paper by Gubser, Nekrasov, and Chadashvili, where instead of some Z2 orbifold, now you just take any arbitrary orbifold where this orbifold group is some discrete subgroup of SU2. Okay. So if you do this orbifold in the right way, it's supposed to be preserve n equals 2 supersymmetry, and you get some gauge group, which is given by some complicated quiver. You can again add a mass term to that chiral multiplet, which sits inside a vector multiplet, to break it to n equals 1 gauge theory with the same gauge group. And these guys argued that this gauge theory was dual to some ADS5 cross X gamma, where these X gamma are the level surfaces of certain generalized conifolds. So you could perhaps repeat this same central charge calculation again. This you could do with the same techniques they used for this T11 case, this gauge theory calculation of the ratio of the central charges. The volume of S5 mod gamma is pretty trivial, but the volume of X gamma, that provided a stumbling block for quite a long time before this formula came out. And you can use this formula I just showed you to compute this, and you can repeat this calculation. So it's kind of nice. And I want to spend the rest of the talk showing you how that works.
You mean the calculation, or this example in more detail?
This example in more detail.
Can you get the same answer?
Always 27 over 32, yeah. There's going to be a paper by Nick Warner and Rich Corrado and someone else. We'll address this mystery of 27 over 32 with some. I think they have some kind of answer involving supergravity. I'm excited to read it.
So is the quiver the same for n equals 2 as for n equals 1?
Yeah, depending on your prescription for drawing quivers, you have to eliminate this chiral multiplet. So maybe I should draw this on the board. Because I'm going to use that for the rest of the talk, pretty much. I'm just going to work my way counterclockwise around that. So what are these gammas? The gammas, right, they're these discrete subgroups of SU2. They have some ADE classification. They're the cyclic subgroups. They're the dihedral subgroups. And they're these exceptional groups, which are roughly the rotation groups for the platonic solids. And you have these simply laced Dinkin diagrams. Now, it's going to turn out that the quivers I'm talking about, they're just these simply laced Dinkin diagrams for these different orbifold cases. Okay. So how does gamma act? Well, it's not so important for the talk, but it acts on a C2, which sits inside this C3, which is the cone over S5. And that's the reason it preserves n equals 2 supersymmetry. Essentially, it leaves some equator on this S5 invariant. But these are the quivers, these simply laced Dinkin diagrams. So the gauge theory of brains sitting at an orbifold point, a C2 mod gamma orbifold point, is well known, right? You just get a gauge group of the following form, some product of unitary gauge groups, right? Where Ni was those numbers, the Dinkin labels on those simply laced Dinkin diagrams, and the big N is just the number of D3 brains you put at the tip of this cone. So the field content, just to review, you get an N equals 2 vector multiplet, and the adjoint of each of these unitary groups, Ni. And for each line in this simply laced Dinkin diagram, you get some hypermultiplet in the bifundamental Ni and J bar. So for me, I'm more interested in this field content in N equals 1 language. Why am I doing all this? I'm doing this because you need to know basically the field content and the R charges of all these fields in order to do the central charge calculation. That's how I'm going to get at the central charge, through summing up R charges. That's why this is important. And you have some vector multiplet, which contains this chiral multiplet phi I. This is the phi I that I'm going to give a mass to. Right. So these orbifold theories have some cubic superpotential, which descends from this N equals 4 theory, this N equals 4 Sobrang Mills. It has 1 phi and 2 b's. And I've suppressed all the indices here for simplicity. They're not really that important. So since these field theories are all super conformal, right, there's some R symmetry. I'm going to use the formalism where theta has R charge 1. So this superpotential will have R charge 2, right? This has to have vanishing R charge if you want to preserve this R symmetry. So it would be consistent to give phi and b R charge 2/3. Those are just the free field R charge values. And indeed, that's the R charge they have. Then what we do, right, is we add a mass term. So we flow to this N equals 1 theory. We give a mass to this chiral multiplet phi. You can integrate out these phis at low energy, and you would get some quartic superpotential. Okay, but now we're in trouble, it seems. If we want this theory in infrared to be super conformal, this would have R charge 8/3. So what has to happen is that the R charge of the Bs changes to 1/2 in the infrared. Okay, so now you know the field content and the R charges of all of these quiver gauge theories. And it's fairly straightforward now to calculate this ratio of central charges. So the result I want to use is a result by Anselmi, Friedman, Griesserow, and Johansson, where they looked at some three-point functions, R symmetry with two stress energy tensors. And they argue that this particular three-point function is proportional to A minus C. And this one with three R symmetry currents is 5A minus 3C. So A is some other anomaly coefficient in these conformal field theories. And basically, because you have one R here, this is proportional to some sum of R charges over the fermions in this conformal field theory. And here you have three R's, so you basically have some sum over R cubed for all the fermions in the conformal field theory. And as I just said, I carefully told you the field content and the R charges in the UV and the IR, so you can go through and calculate these sums and figure out what A minus C and 5A minus 3C are proportional to. And from this information, it's straightforward to compute this ratio. And in every case, you're going to find that it's 27 over 32. And another interesting point here is you're going to see in every case that A equals C, both in the IR and the UV. So this sum of R charges vanishes. And that's well known to be a requirement to have a conformal field theory dual, or a supergravity dual with a conformal field theory.
Why is that true?
Why is that true? Because if you just compute the one-point function of the stress energy tensor for some effective supergravity theory in five dimensions, you find that this thing should be like A times some I'm sure I've switched E and I, but there's some invariance in the curvature, some things quartic in the curvature, and you find that this term vanishes for these ADS theories. So A vanishes. This is a result by Henningsen and Skenderis.
A vanishes or A minus C?
A equals C, right. A minus C vanishes. Sorry. So now we computed this ratio of central charges on the gauge theory side. We have to do it on the gravity side to complete this check. So Gubser, Nekrasov, and Chatashvili argued that this IR fixed point, this IR conformal field theory, is dual to this ADS5 cross X gamma, where these X gamma, right, are the level surfaces of certain generalized conifolds. So what are these conifolds? They're weighted polynomials, weighted homogeneous polynomials, right? The zero locus of these weighted homogeneous polynomials in C4. And this is exactly the kind of situation where this volume formula works. I don't want to give you what all these polynomials are in general. Of course, we don't need them in general. We just need to know what the weights are and the degree and so forth and the dimension. But here's one of them for concreteness. For these cyclic subgroups, these AK series, the polynomials look something like this. Oh, for the E6, I've gone and written what the weights are. But I don't really want to write the polynomial for this case because it's rather complicated. But the long and short of it is that you can go ahead and plug into that formula and calculate the volume of these Einstein spaces. And of course, the volume of S5 mod gamma is trivial. It's just the volume of S5 divided by the order of the orbifold group. And you take the ratio and you again find 27 over 32. So in my last 5 minutes or so, I can give you a sketch of how this proof works. I don't want to give all the details. But basically, the idea is that we started up at the top here with some Calabi-Yau non-compact cone. Call it Y. You quotient by this radius, and you wind up with some Sasaki-Einstein manifold. Call it X. Now, Sasaki-Einstein manifolds are basically U1 fibers over some kind of four-dimensional complex manifold base. And if the Sasaki-Einstein manifold satisfies an additional condition called quasi-regularity or regularity, this base is actually Kähler-Einstein. And I think it turns out that for all of these cones that we're considering, these are all quasi-regular Sasaki-Einstein spaces. So we always have a Kähler-Einstein manifold or orbifold sitting at the bottom. And you can decompose the metric in the following way. You take out the radius, you get a metric on X. You take out the U1 fiber, and you get a metric on V. And moreover, there's this one-form sigma. So in order for this vibration to work appropriately, D of this one form has to be twice the Kähler form on V. So to get the volume, what we do is we basically take advantage of the fact that everything is Einstein here. So you can write the metric as some H, tensor metric, tensor H. You have the Ricci tensor, which you can write in terms of the metric. You have a first Chern clasp, which is often defined in terms of the curvature. And you have some Kähler form omega, which you can define in terms of the metric. And the volume formula on B, you know, you can write as some product of Kähler forms. So you trace back through the series of equalities, and you can write the volume as some integral over first Chern classes.
The metric on the fiber doesn't depend on where you are on the view. You divide by sigma squared.
Right. You'd like to see some additional. I think that would correspond to the case where the fiber is not regular, as far as I understand.
Just some general smooth function.
I think the condition, yeah, I mean, I've suppressed some additional. I've suppressed some additional conditions, but.
It's all working on a compact space.
Right, that's what I'm saying. That's what I was. Yeah.
I'm not going to argue like that.
Yeah, I think basically if this is Einstein, then the fiber has to look more or less like that. if you don't have an Einstein manifold, then you can, I think in general, put some more complicated U1 fiber here, and then that would be an irregular Sasaki-Einstein manifold. I'm actually not an expert, although so all these words amazing.
Anti-canonical bundle would be
different. What's the anti-canonical bundle?
Why is the anti-canonical bundle over V?
Yes, that's true. So now instead of continuing the rigorous proof, I'll just make a couple of claims and sum up. So this integral of first term classes, I claim it's this, the degree times some power of the index divided by the product of the weights. So that would give you the volume on V. And then I just want to claim that the length of this U1 fiber is 2 pi I over N, and that gives you the volume on X. And the way you get these is through a little bit of algebraic geometry. This is basically an intersection number calculation, and this comes from some conditions on the fiber, the way the fiber behaves.
So this formula wasn't known to sort of algebraic geometers?
It may be. My impression is that algebraic geometers don't really care about volumes. If you look in Bessa, for example, you'll find, I think you'll essentially find that the formula I just put up, this one, you'll find this in Bessa. And I guess in many cases, you know, you could actually evaluate this without too much trouble. For example, for the Del Pezzo surfaces, you know pretty much what this first string class is, and you know what the intersection numbers are, and that would come out very straightforwardly. But yeah, I mean, we talked to Janos Kolar. So he knows a fair amount about this stuff, and he didn't seem to think it had been done in this particular form anyway.
Well, a very simple result.
Yeah. So just to sum up, I guess that brings me to the end. So I basically just want to make two points, right? The first was that the conifold is a real fruitful object to study, and there's some other things I'd like to do in the future, maybe based on it. For example, there should be some domain walls in this Klebanov-Strasser background. And these domain walls are BPS objects, and people have calculated in the past they should also have some kind of sine law tension. But at the moment, I have no idea how to see that from the supergravity side. So I thought that might be an interesting project. And another project, thing I've been thinking about for a couple months, made some limited progress, would be to look at the volumes of submanifolds. And why would that be interesting? Well, for example, there's supposed to be these Dibarian operators which correspond to wrapping D3 brains on these submanifolds in these geometries. So if you could calculate the volumes of these submanifolds, you could match the dimensions of these Dibarians with the expectation from the conformal field theory. So at the moment, I have some results on the gravity side, and I can't match it on the gauge theory side in some instances, and the other instances, vice versa. Hopefully, I'll make some more progress along those lines soon. Thanks very much.